White. Silence. A single piano note sounds, plucked rather than struck. With it, a thin black vertical line appears on the screen. Another plucked note accompanies the appearance of another black line. Six times notes are plucked. Six thin, evenly spaced, vertical black lines cross the screen, like bars of a cell. A haunting, mournful, fragile piano line begins off in the distance. The thin black lines recede, more being added to the sides. A hand flutters by, and we realize that the black lines are spaces between piano keys. The camera continues to lift straight up until we see a man in white, head bowed, playing the delicate tune. He is in a white room. Shadows of light coming through a barred door spill across the floor. The piano line repeats, a little stronger this time. The shadows of the door blow open, and a white chiffon scarf floats into the frame, draping itself around the pianist, who stops playing and looks in the direction from whence it came. The piano music continues. The pianist gets up, holding the scarf, and the camera tilts to follow him through the door and out into an impossibly sunny day, with iridescent green grass under a breathtakingly blue sky. A woman in a white dress runs, giggling, up a small knoll to a tree with a swing. The pianist runs after her, laughing. The camera follows them up the hill. The piano line repeats, this time accompanied by a string line playing simple harmony. She sits on the swing, coyly waiting for him. He reaches her and pushes. The swing soars up, her white dress billowing in the wind. She laughs. He laughs. The piano line begins again, and this time the string line plays a different harmony, something softer and darker and full of gentle doubt. He stops her swing. They peer breathlessly into each other's eyes. They kiss. The camera continues to push into her face until it fills the frame, full of simple satisfaction and peace. Her movement slows down until it stops completely. The string line fades away. The piano line begins again, fragile, like the beginning, receding off to the side. The color drains from her face until the image is black and white. The camera pulls back and reveals her picture, torn from a magazine, stuck to a plain white wall, one tattered corner flapping in the gentle wind. The piano continues its faltering melody. The camera pulls away from the picture on the wall and tilts down, revealing dark lines across the white floor. The lines are shadows cast by bars across a window. The piano line, continuing inexorably, fades out to a bare whisper. The camera continues to pull out, revealing a man, the pianist, sitting in the lined shadows against the wall, arms tightly tied around his chest to prevent him from hurting himself. He rocks slowly, softly, his eyes closed, his head bowed. The camera pulls up, revealing the entire room. Four white walls, no door. A tattered picture of an anonymous model torn from a magazine and taped to one of the walls. Strong parallel shadows spilling from the barred window across the floor. And in the corner, forever hugging himself, the pianist rocks. The music has faded away entirely. Silence. White. Thank you. Although never made, this is the short film that saved my college career. I had been stumbling around Hampshire trying to find my niche. I took a photography class to rekindle that fire, but hated it because it was so undisciplined and because the workload was so light. In my high school photography class, we had to produce and match 2 finished prints per week, and then spent the last class of the week, Saturday, thanks to Interlaken's perverse schedule, critiquing the works with the teacher. No holds were barred and no punches spared, and the work got appreciatively better because of it. At Hampshire, because it was so alternative and cautiously inclusive and focused much more on process rather than product, we only had to produce about 6 prints over the entire semester. And the teacher was so wishy-washy that she never actually criticized anybody's work. Even the patently awful series of photographs produced by the student who blindfolded herself as she walked around town taking random shots so that she would not impose her imperialistic gaze on the environment and visually oppress it into the constrictive notions of composition was applauded for her efforts. My advisor was also in the photography department, though he wasn't my teacher. He was about the most unhelpful, least inspiring advisor a student could have. Because I was accepted so late and showed up on campus moments before classes began, I was thrown into his advisee group without him knowing it. I spent all of my first meeting with him listening to him whine that he had too many advisees as it was, and what the hell was he supposed to do with me? He was always incredibly discouraging whenever I met with him, belittling me and my plans. When I proposed my final project, my Div 3, to him, and told him I wanted to go back to the Interlaken Arts Academy for a year and shoot a documentary on their dime and then come back and edit it, he actually said, "That's not going to happen. Why should they give you any money? Who the hell are you?" My other experiences weren't much more encouraging. I dropped an optics class because the professor was so unpleasant and so seemingly uninterested in the topic. My drama teacher seemed more interested in trying to seduce his students than he was about teaching us anything. I was just about at the end of my rope when I got into one of the more popular classes on campus, Visual Literacy and Media Criticism. The class was one of the legendary classes on campus, and I had tried to get into it the first semester but hadn't made the lottery cut. However, my name was put on the waiting list, giving me an advantage in the spring semester, and when that finally rolled around, I got in. It was a fantastic class. We met in a small auditorium with no seats, just wide carpeted steps. It was a groovy idea, but didn't really work. The steps were too wide to sit against the back of one and have your knees bend over the next one, so you either sat with your knees comfortable but no back support, or with half your back supported and nowhere to put your legs. Good in theory, awkward in practice. Very Hampshire. The first day, I walked in, took a spot on the floor, and waited silently with the other students for class to begin. There was a still camera on a tripod on one of the steps, hooked up to a flash in an umbrella, pointing at an empty chair that was sitting in front of the class. A few minutes after class was supposed to begin, I don't think any class ever started on time at that school, much to my irritation. The door swung open, and a thin, sprightly, bearded man walked in with his bag and notebooks. He set them down on the floor, walked up to the chair in the front of the class, and sat down in it, facing us and the camera. He said, "My name is Greg Jones. smiled for the camera, and pushed the cable release. The flash went off, and the automatic film winder advanced to the next frame of film in the camera. He got off the chair and joined us on the steps, quietly facing the front of the class. Mr. Jones is back in town. It's his lucky day. Hold up your hands and shout. Jones is on his way. After an uncomfortable moment, somebody got up, sat in the chair, said their name, and took a picture of themselves. Greg busied himself in his notebook, writing down the name of that person. One by one, we all took our turns in the seat, saying our name and snapping our self-portraits. When we were done, Greg walked to the front of the class and told us that, in the future, we should bring pillows to class, partly to cushion our slim, collegiate butts from the hard floor, and partly so that if we were tired, we could go off into one of the darker corners and take a nap. During class. He said that some of the worst times he spent in college were in classes in which he spent the whole time desperately trying to stay awake. He knew that if he could just crawl off and have a quick 15-minute power nap, then he'd feel much better and could concentrate on the rest of the class. But since he couldn't, he'd spend all of his energy just trying to keep his head from falling over and would miss the entire class because of it. He is not so square. He didn't want us to have to suffer that way, and he'd rather we go to sleep in his class than struggle to stay awake and be miserable. Then he told us about the camera experiment. He had started doing it as an interesting way to learn everybody's name, and as a social experiment, peer pressure in action. But then he noticed an interesting thing. Almost nobody would look at the camera. They'd avert their gaze off to the side and look uncomfortable. If they did look at the camera, it was with a concerned, scowling look. Only once did he ever have a student that faced the camera squarely, gave a big smile, and pushed the shutter button. That student was blind. That started a discussion about pictures and how they steal the soul and being aware of your representation, and visual literacy was off and running. Mr. Jones will help us out. He's a lucky guy. It is Mr. Jones' birthday party for another year. In his hotel room. Although the course materials were starting to get a little dated, full as they were of ads from the 1970s, the work was fascinating, and each class was completely different from the previous one. We talked about how to read an image, or an ad, or a movie. We shared stories about how television affected our perception of reality. We explored the ways the media subtly, or not so subtly, directed our attention to some things and away from others. We studied composition and visual coherence. I loved the work and the class and the teacher, and it was one of the high points of my week. I wanted to get closer to Greg, maybe even get him to be my advisor, but he was an extremely popular teacher on campus, and everybody wanted to work with him. One of our last assignments was to write up a treatment for a film or video project, storyboard it, and defend our choices. I had been fiddling around with my little portable four-track tape deck and had added some primitive synthesizer string lines to a George Winston piano piece I always liked. It was short and bittersweet and evocative, and I decided to do my storyboard project using it. I wrote out a treatment for what I ended up calling White on White and handed it in. This was about the time that my assigned advisor asked me who the hell I thought I was, and there was no way I was going to be able to do my interlocking project. I made an appointment with Greg, hoping I could cajole him into being on the committee for one of my divs, not even dreaming he'd consider being my advisor. When I went in to see him, he was so impressed with my treatment and rationale that I had handed in that he had already cleared a space on his calendar for me and added a section for me in his advisee notebook. He was hoping to talk me into letting him be on my committee, perhaps even my academic advisor. I was stunned. I told him about my idea for my Div 3, and he leapt up and started dancing around the room. He said how great it would be and how we'd start working on it right away to find funding. Perhaps the Corporation for Public Broadcasting would be interested. And this is before I had produced 1 second of video on my own. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Here was one of the most popular and highly sought-after professors on campus leaping about and telling me how fantastic I was and how much he'd hoped I'd let him work with me. I stumbled out of the meeting in a daze. I had a champion. I was going to be all right here. I immediately went over to the photography building and officially told my advisor to fuck off. The piece that had been my inspiration, minus the rudimentary synthesizer embellishments, was from George Winston's landmark album, December. Born in Michigan but raised in Montana, Winston developed a strong sensitivity to the moods and meanings of the different seasons. Picking up piano in his late teens, he released an album of solo ballads and blues in 1972 on the fledgling Windham Hill label. And then he disappeared for 8 years, before starting the season cycle that would bring him fame and almost single-handedly create a new genre of music. His sensitivity of touch and impressionistic pastoral sense and gentle jazz embellishments captured the flow and feel of the seasons perfectly. Better than Vivaldi, anyway. And his albums, Autumn and Winter into Spring, were well regarded and became minor classics in the solo piano genre. Thank you. But it was his next album, 1982's December, that really captured the public's imagination and put Windham Hill in the forefront of what was soon to be called New Age music. Like most genres, the early pioneers were revolutionary, creating stunning and significant bodies of work, soon to be overrun by wan imitators. Nowhere was this more true than in New Age music, which quickly devolved from being a peaceful and tenderly contemplative music, closely aligned to the appreciation of nature and a meditative calm, to a cartoony, babbling brook kind of navel-gazing music, played at yuppie brunches and candlelit poetry readings. But December is remarkable. Combining early Christmas carols with some original compositions, Winston applies his gentle touch and soothing melodic sense to create the perfect evocation of a deep, snowy, silent winter. The dynamics are much more pronounced than one usually thinks of in New Age music, or in winter, for that matter, with moods alternating between quietly solemn and explosively joyful. It is a deliciously intangible combination, meditative without getting sleepy, energizing without becoming bombastic. The music is heartbreakingly happy and almost unbearably sad at the same time. Sacred and humble, the music is unified by Winston's tender touch. Even manages to do justice and bring new life to one of my least favorite pieces in the classical repertoire, the execrable and irritatingly hooky and repetitive Pachelbel's Canon. He treats it almost as a jazz musician treats the blues, using the unwavering circle of chords as a basis for improvisation. He states the chords plainly at the beginning and end of the piece, but then uses them for the foundation of feathery flights of fancy. Forgive me. Other standouts on the album include a contemplative reading of the traditional Jesus, Jesus, Rest Your Head, and a scurrying, excited interpretation of Carol of the Bells, which perfectly captures and expands upon the joyfully overlapping lines of the traditional multi-part vocal showcase. But my favorite piece on the album is the mysterious Minstrels, a traditional song played as the third part of a song cycle called Night, with the first two parts being original Winston compositions. The first movement, Snow, captures perfectly the swirling inevitability of snow falling. Growing up in Michigan, I was quite familiar with snow and the way it transformed landscapes, both exterior and interior. Although fun for the first couple of months, the novelty inevitably wore off long before the snow did. Many, many months before. Our house had a basement that you could only get to by going outside and down a flight of stairs on the side of the house that was covered with a sloping tar paper roof that ended just above the ground, right outside my bedroom window. There was always this feeling of excited dread, of bittersweet contemplation, as the snowflakes landed and instantly turned into water. I knew before very long the sheer quantity of snow would overwhelm the heat of the house, and the flakes would start sticking, and soon the roof would give up its fight and surrender to the awful, ineffable white of winter. I'd marvel at the way the flakes, stunningly beautiful and frighteningly fragile, unable to stand the lightest touch, would keep coming in the millions, eventually conquering everything. George Winston's Snow perfectly captures this mood, this wonderful swirling of the intricately beautiful flakes and the underpinning menace of total domination they represented. Sometimes I'd put on my boots and hat and gloves and scarf and push the door open against the drifts of snow and go walking out through the silent woods in the middle of the night. The snow muffled everything and reflected what little light struck it, making it seem to glow slightly in the moonlight. The blue snow transformed the countryside into an alien landscape, soft and mysterious, all gentle curves and stark contrasts, and trudging through it, it was easy to feel like you were the only living creature. There was such a profound quiet on those nights, and sometimes I would make my way out to the highway and lie down in the middle of it, staring up at the stars, impossibly cold and remote in the barren night sky. No cars ever came down that lonesome road at that time of night, and I could lie there until I got too cold and bored and had no choice but to reluctantly get up and trudge back through the snow to the lonely dark house at the edge of the woods. Such is the sound of the second movement of Winston's Night Suite, called Midnight. Its sparse notes plucked in isolation on the strings of the piano, echoing dully through the impossibly dark night. And then comes Minstrels. Minstrels is a very simple piece, no chords at all, just a concise figure repeated several times over a steady six-note pattern, which changes slightly near the end of the figure before returning to its starting point and continuing. The mix is most remarkable for this piece, and quite uncharacteristic of anything else Winston did, or really anything else in the piano repertoire. It starts off quietly, all in the left channel, the notes so tender that you have to hold your breath to hear them, lest they scatter and melt. As the cycle repeats, the sound centers in the speakers, and the playing gets louder, more assured, but never wavers from the two interlocked patterns. A couple more times through the figure, and the mix slowly moves into the right speaker. As it does so, and the notes slowly lose their resolve, the six-note pattern inexplicably repeats twice between cycles before the melodic figure returns. Now, all in the right speaker, the figures continue and fade out into nothing, never actually ending. It's such a strangely artificial way to treat a piano solo, in that you could never actually play it like that, and gives you the impression of walking by a house in which someone unseen has been playing this figure indefinitely, and continuing to walk off into the woods as the piece continues until it is swallowed up by the perpetual night. It is haunting and heartbreaking and inexplicable, and perfectly encapsulates the deep power of winter, silent and impenetrable, eternal and unforgiving, omnipresent and omnipotent, white, silent. When I die, I want my ashes thrown into Green Lake, just off the shore outside the dance building. Interlaken means between lakes, and the campus does occupy the narrow slice of land between Green Lake and Duck Lake. The Duck Lake side is really only used in the summertime for the National Music Camp, the empty cabins standing quiet and lonely during the winter months. It was a popular place to wander off if you wanted to sneak a smoke, of whatever, or break into one of the drafty cabins. But the Green Lake side is where the academy is located, and it is the lake that was home to me, was my power spot, where an inordinate number of significant events happened. Green Lake was the lake in which I learned how to swim. I would always take the early class, meeting on the dock in front of the hotel at 10 in the morning with my friends. We liked the bracing coldness of the morning lake and the way it was calm and glassy before the tourists and campers had kicked the sand up off the bottom. We were the true inhabitants, the few that lived there all year long, and on those crisp summer mornings, we'd lay claim to the lake. Our lake. My lake. I swam across that lake one summer, a mere half mile or so, but an eternal journey to me, humbling and frightening. I was a strong swimmer, but when I staggered up onto the shore, shaky and sick with exhaustion, I vowed never to take that placid water for granted again. We lived briefly on the peninsula that cut into that lake, directly opposite from the academy. During the winter, the lake would freeze deep enough so that you could drive a car across it, and I'd sometimes walk across the lake on Saturday afternoons to meet my mom after her day of teaching. Because Interlaken ran on a Tuesday through Saturday schedule, I had Saturdays to myself and learned to inhabit the solitude until it became comforting. During the winter months, we were cautioned against walking across the lake, not for fear of thin ice, but for fear of whiteouts. Once, halfway across the frozen expanse by myself, a blizzard blew up and turned the world into a white cotton cocoon. I had heard stories about people panicking in the disorienting blindness of white, stumbling around in circles until they froze to death. But I didn't find it scary at all. The world obliterated, I wandered through a nameless, shapeless void, strangely happy, calm and peaceful in the oblivion. Twenty minutes later, I was disappointed to see the wind let up and the faint gray silhouettes of trees on the shore coming tentatively into focus. I got my first girlfriend on the shores of that lake, and I started losing her on the same shores when I kissed another at the end of my senior year. The first time I got high, I was sitting up in a tree that stretched out over its shallow water with my three best friends, the lights of the academy twinkling in the distance. I camped on its shores. I waded through its shallows. I canoed around its edges and water skied across its jittery waves. I discovered the definitive physical differences between boys and girls as my friends and I splashed in the waves and sprouted into puberty. Our bathing suits suddenly transformed from trivial bits of clothing to exotic vessels containing the most enticing and alluring of mysteries. Like the selfless tree in Shel Silverstein's beautifully heartbreaking book, it was the giving lake, and I drank deep of all it had to offer. But it also took. When my mom and I first moved there, and I was just 7, I used to come down to the dance building with her on Saturdays while she taught. I'd sit in the studio and watch class for a while, and then I'd wander around through the building, peeking into the girls' dressing room, sneaking into the sewing room, and walking slowly through the narrow aisles of costumes, the silks and cottons and scratchy tutu fabrics brushing against my face. And then I'd go outside and play on the shore, obeying my promise of never straying too far away. Interlaken was a safe place, but you couldn't be too careful, and I always kept the dance building close to my back, never going out of earshot of the muffled piano and the creaks of the old wooden building, gently protesting against the jumping dancers within. One day, I was playing in the rocks of the shore when I noticed a log that had washed up. I scrambled over the rocks to investigate it. It was short, but thick, and looked like it had escaped from a woodpile, determined not to be ignominiously incinerated for someone else's warmth. All over the surface, there were what must have been, in retrospect, wormholes. But to me and my fertile imagination, they were exotic carvings, mysterious and pregnant with meaning. They appear to have been carved deliberately. The short curving lines were clearly some sort of code, some mystifying language, ancient and significant. I tried to pull the log out of the water, but it was too heavy and slippery for me to lift. I walked around it and tried again, my shoes soaking up the cold water. I grunted and struggled, and I could turn it over, but I could not lift it. I didn't want to tell anybody else about it, knowing they would take it from me. It was mine, and I was determined to take it home and lay claim to this remarkable artifact. But it was too heavy, and after half an hour of struggling, I gave up and went back inside the dance building and waited for class to be over so my mom and I could go home. The following weekend, I came back down to the shore, and it was still there, beckoning, taunting. I slid down the short bank into the shallow water and tried again. I could move it and tilt it slightly, but then I'd lose my grip on the slippery surface, and the log would splash back into the lake, soaking me. I ran my fingers over the carvings, wondering what they meant. I tried again, and again I failed. I could have asked one of the students or faculty to help me, but I somehow sensed that doing so would break the illusion. They'd be able to lift it out for me, but they'd also have some logical and mundane explanation for those mysterious carvings, and the magic would evaporate. So I struggled mightily against it, grunting and puffing, but time and again, just as I started to lift it, it would slip from my grasp and splash back into the shallow water. Frustrated, I had to admit defeat, and dejectedly went back inside. The next weekend, I wandered back down to the water's edge, hoping the log would still be there, and hoping it had disappeared. Standing at the top of the bank, I could see it there, still nestled against the rocks, its carvings glistening in the sun, the gentle waves lapping softly against the side, making it rock a little. I was just about to go down the bank and try again, when I heard a voice behind me. I turned around and saw a boy, probably 15 or 16, standing a little ways down the beach, in front of the blank brick wall of an unused practice building. He beckoned me over, and I turned from the log and came over to where he was standing. He motioned me closer and stepped into the shrubbery that flanked the low, windowless building. Puzzled, I followed him in. He told me that he would show me his if I showed him mine. I had played this game in nursery school with Allison, but never with another boy. It felt sort of pointless, but he seemed eager to play. So I unzipped my pants and pulled my underwear down, showing him my little boy penis. Then it was his turn, and he unzipped his pants and pulled his cock out. It was long and thick and hard, the skin smooth and insistent. I had never seen anything like it. He asked me if I wanted to touch it. I hesitated. "Go ahead," he urged. So I reached my hand out and grasped his shaft gingerly. It leapt a little in my hand, and I was surprised at how hot and hard it felt, like a smooth rock warmed in the sun. He asked me if I wanted to put it in my mouth, and I recoiled, letting go and stepping back. He pleaded, and I shook my head. I couldn't imagine either why I'd ever do that or why he'd even want me to, so I buttoned my pants and backed out of the bushes, leaving him there and walking quickly back to the dance building, ignoring my mystic log in the lake and taking a seat on one of the benches inside, watching the dancers do their combinations across the floor, listening to my mother count out the beats against the wheezing piano, wondering what had just happened. I didn't tell anybody about it, knowing that somehow I had done something wrong. A couple of weeks later, I was walking further down the shore, in front of an abandoned boathouse, when I ran into that boy again. He told me to come inside the boathouse with him, but I shook my head. He told me he had some pictures of naked women in his wallet, and he'd show them to me if I followed him inside. I had always had a weakness for pornography, boldly sneaking peeks at Playboys in drugstores from the time I was 5, and so I followed him inside the musty building, with its cracked tile floor and overturned boats, covered in tarps, hibernating. He took his wallet out and showed me a couple of small pictures of men and women doing strange things I didn't understand. They were naked, so I knew it must be sex, but it didn't look anything like the solitary airbrushed women I had seen in Playboys. He asked me if I liked them. I shrugged. He asked me if I'd like to do those things. I shrugged. Then he turned me around, pulled my pants and underwear down, bent me over one of the sleeping boats, and fucked me up the ass. It hurt, but I was too scared to really register the pain, and after a couple of minutes, I felt something warm and sticky on my back, and he pulled up his pants and jumped out the window, leaving me disheveled and confused, my pants around my ankles. I slowly pulled them up and walked shakily back home. I didn't want to tell anybody about it, but I was afraid that I was going to get pregnant. So, a couple of days later, I fearfully confessed it to my mother, who, with shaking hands and flushed face, assured me I would not get pregnant, and that what had happened was in no way my fault. And that was it. It was never discussed again, and the incident dropped like a stone into the deep well of my psyche. I don't know what happened to that boy, but I was never the same after that. I had seen the power of unbridled desire, and I never wanted to subject anybody to that. As I grew into puberty, I subverted my lust at every opportunity. Afraid to hurt somebody with it, afraid it would run rampant if left unchecked. I had a penis, there was no denying that, but I never wanted a cock. I never wanted to make anybody feel the way I felt that day, scared and sore and alone on the cold tile floor. And although I had been assured that it wasn't my fault, I had followed him into the boathouse willingly. My sexual curiosity betrayed me and led me into danger. It was a lesson I'd never forget. Fuck comes, etymologically, from the Dutch word fucken, to thrust, or the Swedish dialectical fucka, which means to strike. It is a violent word for a violent act. And, as strong as my desires would run in later years, I couldn't bring myself to fuck. I loved Tina, but I couldn't fucka her. I wanted Jennifer and Lisa and Michelle, but I couldn't prove it to them. I burned with a deep, smoldering flame for years, a fire that would instantly extinguish itself when revealed. I wanted affection. I wanted physical intimacy. But I wanted to be held gently, caressed softly. My cock had been cut off and thrown into the lake that day, leaving me with my little boy penis. And there it would stay, like that mysterious log, ineffable, unfathomable, significant, inscrutable. Too slippery to hold, too heavy to lift. Try as I might, struggle as I may, I could not pull it from those shallow waters and take it home. It wasn't mine to have. And reluctantly, I left it there, and walked slowly down the silent path, my hands buried deep in empty pockets, to the lonely dark house at the edge of the woods. White. Silent.